is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, September 11th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and our producer back in Bristol, Troy Farkas. And you can't mention that phrase, 9-11, September 11th, without thinking of 2001 and all those who were lost on that day and their families who were left behind and all those first responders who moved quickly to help the folks in trouble selflessly. And Troy, I was covering the Yankees at the time, and I'll never forget that fall as the Yankees advanced through the postseason. Every night there would be a line of first responders brought to Yankee Stadium outside of the Yankees clubhouse, you know, to go onto the field and to be part of the national anthem. And man, it just puts a lump in my throat every time I think of those folks and all that they lost.
I know, me too, Buster. I mean, I remember where I was. I was in kindergarten at that time, and those are really my earliest sports memories, is those that Yankees Diamondbacks World Series and when George Bush threw out the first pitch. And I didn't even realize September 11th was coming around until I typed out the word September 11th today, and I was like, oh my God. And I was just overcome with emotion. Every time I think about it, I am. And a big shout out to everyone who helped out on that day.
Yeah, there are dates in this country's history that, you know, November 22nd, you know, the date that John F. Kennedy was killed, December 7th, Pearl Harbor, that absolutely stand out. And obviously 9-11 is one of those days. Last night in Major League Baseball, the Dodgers faced the Orioles with an opportunity to wrap up their seventh consecutive National League West title. Walker Buehler was outstanding, 11 strikeouts over seven scoreless innings, and he got help from Corey Seager.
Here's a fly ball to left. That's well hit. On its way, and it is gone, a home run. Corey Seager, a three-run home run in the first, a two-run blast here in the third, and the Dodgers now have a 6-0 lead.
Damn, 570 LA Sports. Yeah, Dodgers, Orioles, that's like somebody throw a towel, stop the fight. They continued. This was the bottom of the ninth inning.
Ferguson set the pitch to Trumbo. Call strike three. The Dodgers win. After being in first place for all but 6 days the entire season, the Dodgers have won their seventh consecutive National League Western Division title. Once again, the best in the West.
And after the game, they rightly celebrated hard.
Clayton, you've been one of the few members of this team that's been part of seven consecutive championships in the NL West. How does it feel?
It's fun, man. Every year is a blast, and every year, this might be the coldest one I've ever been a part of. My brain is literally hurting.
That's Sam from Spectrum Sportsnet LA. The Athletics and the Astros, and you remember what happened the last few days. The Astros scored 21 runs on Sunday, then 15 more runs against Oakland on Monday. On Tuesday, the Athletics returned the favor.
Left field, hit deep, and that baby's gone.
That from NBC Sports California, and the run just kept on coming for the Athletics.
Here's a base hit to right in an RBI. Solid base hit the other way. Scoring is Profar, and the A's make it a 21-5 ball game.
Yep, 21-7 was the final score. That was Kent Korak, 860 AM, the answer. Crazy game in Detroit. The Yankees had a 6-0 lead early, and they blew it. It was tied in the bottom of the ninth inning when this happened.
Swing a line drive, base hit into right center. Rounding third, hitting home is Castro. Tigers win. Jordy Mercer delivers with a drive up the right center field gap. His entire dugout explodes up the steps and mobs him at second base. What a night at Comerica Park.
Dan Dickerson, 97.1 the ticket for the Yankees. A lost opportunity because we've been talking about how they're in this race for the home field advantage in the postseason. Houston lost last night, but the Yankees also lost to the worst team in baseball, the Tigers. The Twins faced the Nationals, and they took care of business. Mitch Garver helping out.
Pitch a swing and a drive, left field and deep. Back it goes! Second deck blast for Garver. 2-0 Twins.
That from the Treasure Island Baseball Network. Corey Provis with the call. The Twins win 5-0. The Indians face the Angels and Francisco Lindor. added a milestone.
First pitch swinging, Francisco Lindor launches one high and deep to right. Home run, Lindor. And there it is, number 30 for Francisco Lindor. Indians lead it 7-0.
Jim Rosenhaus, 1100 WTAM. Cleveland wins 8-0. And Troy, I'll tell you, when I said that Lindor had a milestone, I didn't really know. I just guessed, because it seems like every home run hit this year is some kind of a milestone, some kind of a record.
I know, and I think last night had the most home runs of any night this season.
Oh, my God. It's crazy. Rays, Rangers, and the Rays took the lead in the top of the 11th.
And the pitch to Heredia. Line drive down the left field line. That gets down for a base hit. Rounding third, Adames on his way home. The throw is cut off. RBI single for Guillermo Heredia. It's 5-3 Rays in the 11th.
That from 620 WDAE, that would be the final score, 5-3. In the American League wildcard race, at the end of the day, Tampa Bay 1.5 games ahead for the first wild card. Oakland 0.5 game ahead of the Indians for the second wild card. Red Sox, they're done. 9 games out in the race for the wild card. In the National League, Mets, Diamondbacks, 2 teams vying for the second wild card. Todd Frazier got a big hit.
Swinging a liner down the left field line. Fair ball. Base hit going into the corner. Cano will score easily. Rosario on his way to third. Rojas up with the ball. Rosario being waved home. Relay throw to the plate. The slide. He's safe. And down to second goes Frazier. 2-run score. The Mets are leading by a score of 2-1.
Howie Rose, WCBS. The Cardinals facing the Rockies. And all of the Rockies' runs came in the bottom of the first inning.
Pitch. Well hit to left, high and deep, and onto the concourse. Touch him all time for Nolan Arenado. 2-0 Rockies.
Yeah, that home run measured at 482 feet to call an 850 KOA, and the Rockies beat the Cardinals 2-1. The Phillies and the Braves and Scott Kingery had a nice moment.
2-1, swinging a high fly center field. It's pretty deep. Acuna drifting back. He's to the track, at the wall, getting ready to jump. He leaps. He brought it back. It's on the warning track. Kingery's around second. He's heading for third. They're waving him to the plate. Albie's throw home, and he is safe. A hit first slide. The ball goes by, and Kingery with an inside the Parker that Acuna kept in the yard. And Kingery homered anyway.
Scott Fransky, Sports Radio 94 WIP, and the Phillies will win this game 6-5 at a time when they're chasing the Cubs for the second wild card in the National League. Chicago in San Diego for the second game of that series, and it didn't turn out well.
Here's Cishek. Inside ball 4. This ball game belongs to my San Diego Padres. On the score, Reyes just touched home plate. It's official. It's a 9-8 ball game.
A walk-off walk allowed by the Cubs. That was Ted Leitner, 97.3 The Fan.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day, because of its importance, was in Miami. The Brewers and the Marlins. And Christian Yelich, a former Marlin, was at the plate in the top of the first inning.
1-1 to Yelich. Hit foul right off the top of Yelich's foot. And he is down on a knee. And now sitting right on home plate. Head down. And Rafael Freitas, Brewers athletic trainer, and Craig Counsell right behind him, out to chat.
That from 620 WTMJ. He would come out of the game with a fractured kneecap. That's how it turned out. After he was evaluated, a devastating blow for the Brewers. He's out for the rest of the year. Word began to filter in the Brewers clubhouse in the top of the fourth inning. That's when Yasmani Grandal did this.
The 2-1. Swing and a shot. This one down the right field line. That's a fair ball. Anderson's going to come in and score. Grandal digging for second base. He will be in standing on a run scoring double. So a pair of doubles for the Brewers in this third inning, and they make it a 3-1 lead.
And they would go on to win 4-3, and at the end of the day, they were just one game behind the Cubs in the race for the second wild card in the National League. But, of course, everyone was concerned about Christian Yelich. Here's David Stearns, the Brewers general manager.
I think first and foremost, we feel awful for Christian. This is a guy who's carried us in a number of ways over the last 2 years. He could have been 2.5 weeks away from a repeat Most Valuable Player award. So I think that's where our thoughts go first. From a team perspective, we have a lot of guys in that clubhouse who will hurt tonight. This is a gut punch for a night, and then we need to recover and play really strong baseball. We've been through this before as an organization. 2 years ago, almost to the day, we lost Jimmy Nelson to a similarly freak injury, and we competed at a very high level for the remainder of that season. And I expect our team to compete at a similarly high level going forward.
A lot of ripples coming off of that injury. Let's get to it. Bob Nightingale, baseball reporter for USA Today, joins us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line, brought to you by New Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline. Now with four levels of defense against gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction. And Bob, obviously, the top story of the day, Christian Yelich out for the year after fracturing his kneecap. Personally, I think the Brewers can withstand this, but this is like the Patriots losing Tom Brady. That's how important Yelich is to the Brewers. What do you think?
No, I agree, Buster. I think it's going to be tough for them to recover from it, just emotionally, everything else. I mean, he was putting on a great MVP push, and certainly he's having a better year than he did a year ago. They were red hot. He was red hot. Heard about the scene in the clubhouse. You saw the videotapes. You see everybody was so down. He's got tears in his eyes. They do have a very favorable schedule where they got three games left against the Cardinals, and that's it as far as teams over 500. But yet, I think there's so much dejection. I think it's going to be tough for them to overcome.
Yeah, now, part of the reason why I think they actually could make in, there are three reasons for me. One, I feel like they've got a great clubhouse culture, and they're a small market team, so they're used to adversity. It's amazing that they're even in this position, given how tattered their pitching staff is. Now, every game, when I watch the Brewers, you look at the Craig Counsell's face, and you can almost see the look on his face like, now, how am I going to get 27 outs tonight with the way that his staff is lately? Two, and you mentioned the favorable schedule that they have. They play the Cardinals this weekend. And besides that, they play essentially some of the worst teams in baseball for the rest of their games. And meanwhile, the Cubs, the team they're chasing, seven of Chicago's last 10 games are against the Cardinals. And three, let's face it, in this race for the second wild card in the National League, it's not like we're talking about, all these teams reminding you of the 27 Yankees. Like all of these teams have their issues, and that's why I wouldn't completely rule out the Brewers winning this spot.
Yeah, I mean, so much depends on the Cubs. I mean, like you said, the Cubs are chasing the Cardinals, still four games back, seven or last 10 against St. Louis. And the Cubs are keeping this door wide open. I mean, I thought they should be running away with the division, much less a wild card berth. Then they have games like last night with a walk-off walk. Should be losing games, like that to San Diego Padres. And you wonder, I mean, if the Cubs at some point here have got to turn it on, or there's going to be some big-time changes over there.
Yeah, that's my sense, too. I feel like if the Cubs don't make the postseason this year, all bets are off in the revamping of this team. What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. Obviously they would make a change at manager, maybe some of the coaches as well. And revamping that whole lineup where, they go into the winter telling teams, hey, pretty much everybody's available here. Who do you got to trade? And just to turn things around. Because, you're talking about the Colorado Rockies and Chicago Cubs, probably the two most disappointing teams, certainly in the National League.
I think the Cubs would tell other teams, Javier Baez is off limits, Wilson Contreras is off limits, we'll talk about anybody else, including Anthony Rizzo, including Chris Bryant. Do you agree?
I agree. And I think they say, let's see what we can do, because this offense is disjointed right now. And, there's no way they should be playing like this, especially when they made all those trades at the trade deadline, and worked out. I mean, where would they be even without Castellanos? And this guy just arrived.
let's double back a little bit on Yelich. Not that it's really that important, but what do you think this does to his chances for winning a second straight MVP?
Oh, I think kills it. I think he's got no chance now. I would be hard-pressed to see him get, you know, a single first-place vote. Where before he was making a push, I still think it was, you know, Bellinger's MVP to lose, particularly if the Brewers hadn't made the playoffs. If the Brewers had made the playoffs, they would have been a very close call. But now I could easily see, you know, Cody Bellinger winning MVP pretty easily, unless Rendon here, you know, makes a final surge in, you know, it makes things interesting. But I got a feeling now that Rendon may slip past Yelich.
An injury that's not getting as much attention, Byron Buxton of the Twins wound up having shoulder surgery yesterday. He's out for the rest of this year. They, of course, lost Michael Pineda to a PED or diuretic suspension the other day for the rest of the year. What do you think the impact of the Buxton injury is on the Twins?
I'm not sure they were counting on him just because they've been so beat up over the year. And, you know, it was kind of fear, like, would this guy even come back? But, yeah, it just starts to pile on here. I mean, still a very good ball club. Certainly they should still win the Central. But you just wonder how in the world are they going to get past the Yankees or Houston the first round. That part's a little hard to see.
Yeah, that's when we were talking about the Brewers before, I think they could still make the playoffs, but I can't imagine a scenario where they would actually have a chance to make it to the World Series. And I feel the same way with about the Twins with those two superpower teams in front of them.
Yeah, they're just too good. You know, particularly the Yankees. I mean, then it's just a mental thing. I mean, you remember, Buster, when you're covering the Yankees, the Twins could never beat them. And several times, they had a better team. And just a, you know, whether it's a blown save here or there, miscues, but it's almost in their head. It's mind-boggling to see the number difference in Yankees and Twins over maybe starting in late 90s. They used to have their number.
So I want to ask you about a situation that happened with the Pirates yesterday. Kyle Crick, one of their relievers, required season-ending surgery for his right index finger after he was injured in a clubhouse fight with fellow reliever Felipe Vasquez. This is not the first incident involving Kyle Crick or the Pirates. Earlier this year, the club suspended Keona Kayla for 2 games for arguing with a coach. Their bullpen coach was suspended for 2 games. He had an altercation with Crick. I'm sure you've heard the story about how a couple players, including Crick, were screaming at Rob Beertemple, the beat reporter from The Athletic. It was apparently very ugly. And Kayla and Crick were involved in a brawl in the fight that happened with the Cincinnati Reds. At some point, I'm thinking Kyle Crick better make better career decisions because he finishes this year with a 3-7 record and a 4.96 ERA, Bob. Maybe he should avoid these type of things a little better.
Yeah, you can get away with it when you're riding high and the king of the pitching staff. But you're right. I mean, his personality just, you know, it kind of flew back in the day, but not now. You can't do those things. Before, you know, these type of guys in baseball, you learn to deal with them. And now people aren't. You know, I was a little surprised and pleasantly that the Pirates, you know, came out and said exactly what caused the injury and everything else. You know, they're very transparent about it. But with all these things that are going on, you really wonder what's going to happen in Pittsburgh at the end of the season. You know, what kind of changes do they make? You know, is Neil Huntington back? Is Clint Hurdle back? You know, too many things are happening in Pittsburgh.
The one thing I would bet the family farm back in Vermont on, Kyle Crick will not be on the 2020 Pirates. That's my guess on the day, Bob. What do you think?
You're probably right. I mean, just nobody wants to put up with that. You can put up with it, you know, if you're a 20-game winner or, you know, saving 40 games. But you can't unless you're a big-time player on a team. And you wonder, too, you know, does this, you know, kill trade value type thing. You know, you wonder when these guys do things, just how does it affect the value? Because, you know, nobody puts up with it anymore. They used to, but not anymore.
All right, I want to ask you about what happened in Boston earlier this week, the after-midnight firing of Dave Dombrowski, of course, the head of baseball operations for the Red Sox. Here's Alex Spear of the Boston Globe, was on Spain and Company, talking about the toxic championship or bust mentality around Boston sports.
I do think that there is a championship or bust mentality that that follows all of the pro sports teams at this point. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's an incredible period of time. There's a sense of, you know, of disappointment. Like, it's really kind of a championship robust mentality. It's a really, really difficult operating environment, one that can be really challenging for players to be able to kind of maintain their sanity through, and one that's going to raise questions, I think, for some of the candidates who the Red Sox will want to pursue as Dombrowski's replacement. I think that it's still a very appealing job, but the fact that they replaced a guy less than a year after a record-setting season is going to raise some very interesting questions about, well, okay then, so what are your standards for success?
Right.
And why are you going to tell me you're not going to fire me after X month on the job?
Yeah, when I covered the Yankees, and George Steinbrenner was the owner, I referred to that as the Steinbrenner doctrine, is that if you don't win the World Series, then you suck. And that sort of situation has developed around the Red Sox, the expectations from ownership there. Bob, what's your read on who could potentially be in line here for following Dave Dombrowski, head of baseball ops?
You know, I still think it's a very appealing job, and this goes past wins and losses. I mean, if it was simply about wins and losses, Dave Dombrowski would have had an extension spring training. You know, Alex Cora got one, Dave Dombrowski won and won. And I'm reaching out to Dave in May because I heard he's very upset about it. You know, he downplayed it, but it was clear, you know, it involved more than wins and losses. You know, maybe it'll come out, you know, someday. I keep hearing it's going to be someone with Red Sox roots. I can't imagine Theo Epstein going back, but the name doesn't go away. You know, Mike Hazen in Arizona, but I can't imagine Diamondbacks letting him in, you know, letting him interview there. You know, even Allard Baird, you know, was a Red Sox employee. Now the assistant GM of the Mets. But you keep hearing it. Someone, it's going to be someone that they're very comfortable with that used to work for the Red Sox. So they're certainly out there, you know, a lot of great names. You know, Jed Hoyer's the number two guy in Chicago. Certainly they will let him go because then he'd be the top guy there. You know, would the Red Sox dare give, you know, a piece of the pie or some ownership to Theo Epstein to come back. So I think they're going to go after one of the big dogs here and try to lure them back.
And as Peter Gammons mentioned in the podcast yesterday, it's a fascinating question when you're talking about Theo Epstein, because when he left the Red Sox after 2011 season, it was ugly. Like, he was persona non grata there as far as the Red Sox ownership was involved. But, you know, over time, I mean, nobody had an uglier exit in Boston than Manny Ramirez, and he was brought back out to throw out a first pitch, and he was honored there. And you do wonder, as the Red Sox look ahead and they try to reshape the team, and Sam Kennedy, the president, and of course, childhood friends with Theo Epstein, to me, one, I think that if you're the Red Sox ownership, you almost have an obligation to ask the Cubs about Theo and to ask Theo what he wants first. And I tell you what, if he wants that job, if you're Tom Ricketts and Theo were to come to you and say, you know what, it's time for me to go back home, I'd have a hard time standing away of that, given that he's gone to Chicago and he's really given the Cubs what they were looking for. It feels, I know the last few years have been disappointing for the Cubs, but it does feel like mission accomplished for what Theo was brought there to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they would let him go. I mean, obviously, it'd be a lateral move. He'd have to get some kind of, you know, maybe a part ownership stake. And, you know, I think Theo does want to own a team or be part of the ownership ranks, you know, with the Red Sox grand to him. And I think Theo could sell it to Chicago people and Tom Rickards by saying, hey, Jed Hoyer's been a GM before. He can certainly do it. He and Jason McLeod were together in Boston. I mean, in San Diego as well. So, you know, you're good hands here with those two guys. So, yeah, I just don't know if the Red Sox would step that far, you know, and give him a piece of the team. You know, it's like Billy Beane has a small piece of the Oakland A's.
Yeah, what do you think Theo's reaction would be if the Red Sox actually, if John Henry, Tom Werner put the history aside and actually, you know, hat in hand went to him and said, look, we want you back?
I think it was, you know, asking a lot of questions, saying, okay, you know, how long is the contract? I'm the highest paid GM in baseball right now. You know, it's going to take something more than just, you know, money here. You know, do I have full autonomy? Can I make a lot of moves? Am I involved more than just the baseball operations part? Because, I think Theo, you know, gets bored at times. I mean, he's already won the World Series in Chicago. You know, much better place than he were when he first got there. and see what it takes. I think, you know, Theo can get bored at times. I'm not saying he's bored with the Cubs, but I think this would be a new opportunity. And I think anybody that knows Theo knows that when this contract is up, he's probably leaving Chicago anyway to go on to you know, different things.
Yeah, I think there would be two conditions to your points. One, essentially, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it, a lifetime contract. Like, I don't think he would want to be there and then be immediately be put on notice if they had a couple of bad years. And two, an option to buy the team whenever John Henry decides to sell the team. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you, the option part. You know, certainly he's got a lot of friends in high places where they can raise the money. Yeah.
Eddie Vedder.
He'll say, hey, if Tom Henry walks out or John Henry, you know, Tom Warner jumps out, you know, we can make a move here and get ownership stake. Because that's the one thing you hear from Theo's friends, that he would like to be in the ownership ranks, that would be the next step. I thought it was going to be after he left the Cubs. But, yeah, I mean, you maybe leave a couple years early.
All right, Bob, thanks for doing this. Great to talk with you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Buster.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
Hembo is Paul Imbakides, who claims to be the head honcho of the show Get Up, and he joins us every week here on the show, but he may not next week because, Hembo, you're getting married on Saturday. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Buster. That comes with good and bad news. The good news is that, of course, I'm off the market for the scores of eligible women that listen to this podcast. I've been dying to know that, of course. But it's bad news because she's a Yankees fan, and I, like most people, hate the Yankees. So the good thing is that she's a much more passionate football fan than she is a baseball fan. But her mother bought me a Yankees T-shirt last year for Christmas, and I frankly haven't worn it once.
Yeah. That's a hard one. Like, yeah. You having the in-laws give you the shirt of a team that you hate.
Yeah.
I hope she did it with a sense of humor. Did she even have any idea?
I think it was more based around ignorance. Like, oh, you like baseball. Here's my favorite baseball team. So this is a football family, as you can clearly tell, but I'm gonna have to massage my way through that one.
Yeah. And Troy, I know you had some thoughts on this.
What is the total number of beers that will be consumed by you, Hembo, at the wedding? I need those kind of numbers.
I don't know how many beers that I will consume, but I'm sure my buddies will break New Jersey state records and probably get the municipality in trouble for some sort of noise complaint. That's the kind of friend that I have for some reason engendered in my life. But look, I'll have a full cavalcade of numbers for you in my week back from Aruba, and I'm hoping to have a nice little suntan to go with it. I know, Buster, how much you love spending time on the beach.
Oh, I just, nothing better than sitting on the beach and just frying reading a book.
Yeah, man.
No, that's pretty bad.
Your skin can't quite handle it. I've seen darker shades of milk, frankly.
All right. You know, enough insulting me. Let's get to this week's notes, which starts with Walker Buehler, who starts on Sunday Night Baseball for the Dodgers against the Mets.
The Dodgers staff includes the league's ERA leader in Hyunjin Ryu and perhaps the greatest starter of all time in Clayton Kershaw, but Walker Buehler should be the Dodgers' game one starter in the postseason, and I'll give you three reasons why. First, Buster, he pounds the strike zone. Buehler ranks second among all qualifiers in strike percentage and percentage of pitches thrown in the strike zone. As a result, he owns the fourth lowest walk rate in the league. Two, he has multiple put-away pitches. Buehler ranks eighth in fastball strikeouts, but also has 20-plus strikeouts using his curveball, his slider, and his cutter. He's the only pitcher in baseball with that distinction. And three, his effectiveness does not wane late in games. Opponents are batting 194 with a 516 OPS against him after the sixth inning. And given the Dodgers' bridge issues in the bullpen, that is a welcome sight.
And if there was a statistic for confidence, he would be running from all other players in baseball.
That Vanderbilt education.
Exactly. That 100%. He has a lot of confidence. And I suspect we'll be hearing from him on Monday's podcast. The Houston Astros are beginning to take control of this race for the best record in baseball with those big run totals on Sunday and Monday. What do you got in the Astros?
They got pummeled yesterday, but they are finishing off a 3-year run, Buster, the likes of which we have rarely seen. First, Houston is 5 wins away from its third consecutive 100-win season. The last team to pull that off was the Yankees from 2002 to 2004. Secondly, the Astros own a run differential of plus 700 over the last 3 seasons. That would be the best mark in a 3-year span since the Cardinals from 1942 to 44. And lastly, Only one team in the modern era, which dates to 1900, has measured 20% above average by ERA plus and OPS plus. That team was the 1927 Yankees, and Buster, the 2019 Astros are on pace to do just that.
Wow. And I know that the baseball is different, but at the same, wow, that is a great statistic. And you want to talk about a particular Padre.
The Padres play on ESPN tonight without the most important player the franchise has developed in years, and that, of course, is Fernando Tatis Jr. Consider this. San Diego averaged 4.6 runs per game with him in the starting lineup, but only 4 without him. Only the Marlins and Tigers have averaged fewer over the course of the season. He's that kind of important to the lineup. Further, only 3 players have produced a slugging percentage greater than his in a season at the age of 20 or younger. Those 3 players, Buster, are Mel Ott, Alex Rodriguez, and Ted Williams. Well, I really, really, really wish for our, I think this is one of the very few broadcasts we've had of the Padres on our air tonight. I so wish he was playing.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, have fun at your wedding. I would give you the same advice I give to a lot of folks who are going to be newlyweds, and that is make sure, insist that, tell everybody who's at your wedding, put away your personal issues. Today is my day, but you know what? That's how you view every day.
Every day is
Thanks
my
for
day.
Joining the show.
Later, boys.
Joel Sherman is a columnist for the New York Post. He's an analyst for the MLB Network. Joel, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Buster, yourself?
I'm doing great. And, of course, terrible news last night about Christian Yelich. I was talking with Bob Nightingale about that situation. And just a quick question for you as someone who's voted on awards in the past. Do you think in the end that this winds up costing him the MVP?
I certainly think it could. If you remember, the narrative last year is a strong finish by him really galvanized, sealed the deal. It was probably pretty close 1-2 with Bellinger. On the other hand, by sheer coincidence, on the night that this happened to Yelich, Bellinger's Dodgers clinched the NL West. So, his playing time, will it be consistent down the stretch for him to keep adding numbers? And as much as we've become a very analytical world, to me, Buster, a lot of voters are still swayed by narrative. What does it mean if Arizona was to sneak in and Ketel Marte had a great last 2.5 weeks? What would it mean for Washington, which seems in a dominant position, to go ahead and galvanize it for Anthony Rendon? So while these other players could continue to add to both their storyline and their stat line for the season, unfortunately for the Brewers and really the whole sport, because he's such a great player, Yelich just won't be able to keep doing that this season.
Yeah, and then the last National League player to win back-to-back MVPs, Albert Pujols, 2008 and 2009. You and your colleague Kevin Kernan had a piece earlier this week about Noah Syndergaard of the Mets, which is primarily why I wanted to have you on to talk about that, how he had lobbied to the Mets, been upset at the Mets recently because he had been paired with Wilson Ramos as his catcher. Statistically, he's performed much better with other catchers. Wilson Ramos, as you know, doesn't have a great reputation as a defensive catcher, but he's a terrific offensive player. And so there was a back and forth on that. Here was Noah Syndergaard yesterday responding to your report.
First and foremost, the whole idea that we had a livid, or I was livid with the conversation, that was completely false. We had a very cordial and adult conversation about the matter. As far as Wilson, I have nothing but respect for the guy. It doesn't change our relationship between one another. And he busts his ass every day. Ultimate respect for him. But my only main concern was just having an open dialogue with the front office and coaching staff of my initial frustration of why there was these extreme splits with different catchers. More so the matter is it's all on me. It's just that I'm just trying to look for an answer. I'm just working on becoming more consistent with whoever's behind the plate, and I'm going to go out there and compete with whoever is behind the plate.
So, Joel, where do you think this stands now?
Well, I think it will be interesting. I believe he starts again on Friday. Who he gets? This situation, we could play semantic games, but this didn't occur over the last week. He has been upset earlier in the season when he was matched up with Ramos. In mid-June, he had a game against the Cardinals where he did not pitch well, and the Cardinals stole 5 bases on him. And he was very close to, I believe, going off at that point and saying something. And he ended up on the injured list for 2 weeks with a hamstring injury. And when he came back, magically, his next 7 starts were with Thomas Nido catching him. And, by the way, he had his best run of the season. And, by the way, the Mets got back into contention behind a lot of things, but namely their very strong starting pitching, pitching well, including him pitching well. And then Ramos, as you mentioned, he is a good hitter. He's probably been there right there with Alonso and McNeil, their best hitter in the second half. And he started to mix back in with Syndergaard. Syndergaard had maybe the worst start of his career with Ramos behind the plate in the Cubs. And then we had last weekend where the Mets had night game, day game. And as soon as he saw that Nido was catching a second straight night game, it was Ramos Friday night, then Nido on Saturday for Stroman. He recognized they were never going to bench Ramos for a second straight day because of the bat. He was upset. We could call it upset, lithered, frustrated, but it's a season-long simmer. And he went to management and said, why not? I mean, if he's going to play twice this week and it's not day game after night game, why not just have Ramos catch Stroman? And, you know, and then Ramos caught him, and he didn't pitch particularly well on Sunday. And, you know, here we are. I would say, big picture, this is not unfamiliar. There are pitchers who don't care and will call their own game out there and just set up the target. And there are pitchers who care a lot, most famously maybe Greg Maddux, right? Didn't want to pitch to Javier Lopez. And, you know, Eddie Perez was his guy. But I would even point to a real similar situation on a championship team. In 2009, the Yankees had a situation where A.J. Burnett, very much Syndergaard-type, tall right-hander, you want to go blonde? I'll go blonde. Very talented, but never meshed with Jorge Posada, who was a Wilson Ramos-like catcher in that he led with his offense, and pitchers had real problems with him. And his backup was Jose Molina, very much in the Rene Rivera, Thomas Nido mold. And Burnett liked to pitch to him. And Joe Girardi had to make the manager of that team had to make a very difficult decision. You know, Posada, as opposed to Ramos, was a champion, an important person on the Yankees in the clubhouse at that point, an important person in their history. And you know what he did for the better of the pitcher and the team? He matched up Molina with Burnett, including in playoff games, sitting Jorge Posada. And he got the best of Burnett in that postseason. And I know people say, shut up and do your job. But the idea is you need to maximize the performance of your players, especially your best players. And I wonder if Mickey Callaway and Brody Van Wagenen and the Mets simply must give something that comforts this particular pitcher and give him the catcher he wants the rest of the way, when pretty much they have to get close to winning out.
Yeah, and I that's what I think they should do. Look, as you mentioned, there's lots of precedents for this. You know, before A.J. Burnett, there was David Cohn back in the 90s with Posada. You know, a few years ago when the Dodgers moved on from A.J. Ellis, they basically split him apart from Clayton Kershaw. I talked yesterday in the podcast about how a general manager at the time said, look, if Clayton Kershaw wanted his uncle to catch him, I would let him do that if he thought that made him better. 2016, John Lester, David Ross, at a time when Wilson Contreras was, you know, a young, up-and-coming, clearly more talented catcher. And I am going to be curious about what happens on Friday, because this late in the season, yeah, you give Syndergaard whatever he wants because he's the most important guy in that given game. What do you think's going to happen?
I think he's going to get what he wants because, you know, the catching as opposed to other positions, even this late in the season, you really can't play a guy into the ground and play him every day. And look, we're much more sophisticated. We actually have numbers. And it's not just the matchup numbers, which show, like, Syndergaard has a much higher ERA with Ramos. He has a much higher OPS with Ramos. It's just go to Ramos's framing numbers, they're among the worst in the sport. His ability to get, you know, Syndergaard's best pitch is his sinking fastball. Ramos is as big a catcher as probably there is right now in the major leagues. It's hard for him to sit low and get that pitch called consistently, where Rivera and Nito do. So, you know, the problem, of course, is like he matched up Nito with Stroman, because Stroman's best pitch is also a sinker, right? It's a sinker-slider guy, and you probably want a guy who could help at the bottom of the zone. This was the problem with getting Ramos in the first place. He's a designated hitter dressed up as a catcher in a league without a DH. And so you are always going to, in a time where it's more difficult for teams to start non-defensive catchers because people are paying more attention to it. The Mets went out and made a 2-year investment in this. And Buster, forgive me for the long-windedness, this is part of the drama and soap opera with the Mets also, right? Brody Van Wagenen gave a 2-year contract to Ramos. He obviously wants him to do this. Conversely, Noah Syndergaard is very aware that Brody Van Wagenen was Jacob deGrom's agent last year. And last year encouraged Jacob deGrom, who wanted to throw to Devin Mesoraco, that he had the heft to go into Mickey Callaway and say, I want to pitch to Devin Mesoraco. I pitch best. They gave him Devin Mesoraco in 21 of his last 25 starts, and he won the Cy Young Award. And so, like, Brody Van Wagenen has now moved on to the other side of the table, and it probably feels, to Syndergaard at least, a little hypocritical if you come in and say this is going to be a player's first administration, which is what Brody said, that when a player comes up and says, this is what I need to be successful, you say, no, I signed this guy to a 2-year contract. He's the catcher.
Yeah, 100%. And look, I definitely want to get you back on at some point to dive more into the Mets situation, because as soon as you would assume there's a good chance they're not going to make the playoffs, as soon as that happened, man, they are going to have a mess on their hands. But we'll get that to that another day. A minute to go. Tell me what your read is on the Red Sox situation.
The Red Sox situation, to me, Buster, I'm not a conspiracy theorist by nature, but the way this is handled, there has to be more to this story than meets the eye, because to dismiss Dave Dombrowski after midnight of a nationally televised game, your game on ESPN, with the biggest rival in town, which means the New York media in town, there's a wraparound game on Monday, which means the New York group is still going to be there. And whatever you think of Dave Dombrowski and his tactics, they were well known. It was why he was hired. They didn't think Ben Cherington, the previous GM, could take the ball from the red zone into the end zone with that group. They wanted a finisher. They thought this guy would be a guy, he would spend the money, he would spend the prospect capital, and he would go for it. By the way, he spent the money, he spent the prospect capital, he finished first, and first. The third time was the charm. They won a championship. They stepped back this year. Their near future now looks a little more cloudy. To me, a mature ownership group comes out and says exactly that. Hey, we switched from Ben to Dave because we thought that was the kind of caretaker we need. We believe we need a different kind of caretaker to clean up our prospect base and to clean up our payroll, and we're going to go there. We own the Boston Globe. We believe in being honest and whatever. How do you not hold a press conference for this? How do you put it all on Alex Cora unless you're not telling me something and you don't want to tell the public something? Again, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. Maybe it's all just that they're cowards and they're not accountable. But to me, Buster, I'm sitting here going, I'm waiting for, is there another shoe and is it falling and it's going to drop?
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought it was totally gutless that the ownership of that team wasn't there at the press conference, especially for someone of Dombrowski's stature. You know, he deserved that. Certainly the fan base deserve an explanation. Joel, I look forward to talking with you again. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Great, Buster.
Because we're tired of getting yelled at for somebody else's work.
Bias!
And would rather get yelled at for the stupid stuff that we do.
And this is why the Seattle Mariners will play in the 2016 World Series.
Oh, what a loser!
This is the Baseball Tonight Power 10.
Yeah, and I know last night was ugly for the Astros, but I think after what they did on Sunday and Monday that we're going to agree at the top of the Power 10. Troy, I've got the Astros at 1. I've got the Yankees at 2. I've got the Dodgers at 3. What about you?
I also agree. Astros at one after the offensive performances we've seen, and just I can't get over how good Verlander and Cole are. Two Dodgers, three Yankees.
I've got four Braves. My son, thankfully, you know, I have to live under the same roof as him, and he would have gone nuts if I hadn't done better because they have been playing well of late. The Twins, having lost Buxton, I've got them at number five. I've got the Cardinals at number six, seemingly now in control of the National League Central.
Okay. I've got the Braves at four, Twins at five. Agree there. I'm not ready to move the Cardinals up that high yet. I still have Tampa Bay at six.
Yeah, and you have to tip your cap to what the Rays are doing. I've got them at seven, Oakland eight, Indians nine, Nationals 10. What about you?
How about that? So we have the exact same 10 teams. So I've got the Rays at six, the A's at seven, Cardinals at eight, Indians at nine, Nationals at 10.
Where'd you put the Rangers on your list? I hope they're not like 10A or something
like
that.
They didn't make the cut. I mean, tough loss to the Rays last night. Had it swung in our favor, they might have sneaked in this week, but here we are.
Here we are.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster, a few Bleacher Tweets for you this morning to continue the conversation about Dave Dombrowski. Here's the tweet from P.K. Steinberg at P.K. Steinberg. Andy McPhail was hired by the Phillies a few weeks before Dombrowski was hired by the Red Sox. Dombrowski won a World Series and was fired. Should the Phillies move on from McPhail?
What I hear is that John Middleton, who, of course, is the head honcho of the Phillies, is evaluating things. Because even if they make the playoffs this year, let's face it, they have not performed to the expectation of what the Phillies ownership thought be going into the last 2 years. They spent a lot of money, they've given up a lot of resources, and they haven't exactly taken off.
Next one comes from Houston Ken at Houston Ken. With Yordan Alvarez and Pete Alonso looking like winners of Rookie of the Year, which one would you prefer as a building block for your team?
Houston, that is a great question, and I have not been around the Astros in the last month or so to ask questions about, you know, how Alvarez in the clubhouse. I hear great things about his acumen. He asks a lot of questions. He can make adjustments, and that's great. I think it probably would go with Alonso because he can play in the field more readily. He's become a good defensive, an average defensive first baseman based on his work, and I know this. I mean, he's already is accepted as basically the leader of that clubhouse. Yesterday, Troy was doing some research on him to get ready for Sunday Night Baseball this week. We've got the Dodgers playing at Citi Field. Like, Pete Alonso in high school won the leadership award. And then when he was in college, he won the leadership award. He was a National Honor Society member. Like, this is part of who he is. He's being a guy right in the middle of a team.
No matter who you choose for this answer, it seems like both teams will love these guys for years to come. Next one comes from Jeremy T. at Jeremy Tirmini. With 3 weeks left in the regular season, what are the chances that two NL teams not currently in playoff positions sneak in as wild cards? Milwaukee and Arizona have the easiest remaining schedules, and I think they've passed both the Nationals and Cubs. What say you, Buster?
No, I think the Nationals are going to make it, but I don't think the Cubs are. Like, I think the fact that they have to face the Cardinals 7 of the last 10 games will take them down. And as I was talking about with Bob, Troy, man, I think they're, I mean, you could basically just go into that room and just say, you know what, we're going to rip this thing up and we're going to turn this over.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Cubs in their future. Last tweet from Gnome at Gnome 89, staying in Chicago, but on the other side, the White Sox have the AL leaders in batting average and RBI, a starter who will pick up some Cy Young votes, and the minor league player of the year. Are you buying what is being built on the South Side?
Yeah, sort of. There's no question they're making progress. I do think that they need a cash injection, so to speak, of a major free agent. I think Jerry Reinsdorf recognized that, which is why he had some cursory conversations with Bryce Harper and actually made a pretty good offer to Manny Machado. There was a time when the White Sox actually think that they would land him, and I think this winter they could be a landing place for one of the big free agents.
I look forward to the day I get a cash injection, but until then, keep sending me your Bleacher Tweets every morning. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Joel Sherman, Bob Nightingale, to Hembo, and to Troy. Have a good day, everybody, and again, 9/11, think about all those folks who were lost in that day and their families.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.